So what the subject of today's class is going to be, or today's lecture, is, well, there's a couple of things. It was the 3-2-1 process of shadow that that I developed for integral recovery, and how it came, kind of came out of my practice. And I got the idea of 3-2-1 of shadow from Ken Wilber and what in the ILP package. And somehow I completely developed this thing independently, just like I thought that name was great, and somehow it evolved into this. And then I went back and looked at what they were calling the 3-2-1 of shadow, and it's completely different. So it bears the same name and has very little to do in relationship to what it actually is. But all that to say, I wanted to start with, as long as we're on this 3-2-1 deal, is talk about the 1-2-3 or the 3-2-1 of God. Are you guys familiar with that concept?
Vaguely.
Okay, good. Vaguely is good. Yeah, you probably heard it mentioned somewhere. And at any time, if you can just say, excuse me, and I'll stop if you have a question or comment. I don't know if it's a virtual way to raise your hand here or not, so you'll have to come in verbally. But anyway, I just, as long as we're on the 3-2-1 subject, I think this thing, 3-2-1 of God, is really, really useful. And when I first was, you know, having my, you know, integral awakening, if you will, and learning all this stuff, it was quite exciting and really helped me out, because I was just beginning to be really disciplined about an interior practice, about meditation and contemplative prayer, et cetera. And this stuff is great. And basically what the 3-2-1 of God is that these are all perspectives that one can take, okay? And a lot about the whole integral thing is being able to take, you know, perspectives. And so, you know, when you're dealing with addiction, it's very important. A lot of us have firsthand experience of recovery, and that's a first person a perspective of, you know, being an addict and struggling with this overpower craving to take and use drugs that you can't control and dominate your life and begins to kill you. So that's a really useful perspective, but that's not the only perspective. The second person perspective would be talking to my, or you're being in relationship with another person who is an addict. Okay, so you're personally connected to someone who's an addict besides yourself. So you can kind of see, and from that second person perspective and being in relationship, what that's like. And of course, we all know that the suffering of addiction is not in any way stops with the addict. The suffering occurs in all the relationships and family, personal, professional. People that are become victims of crimes and different behaviors, criminal behaviors, because of the addiction. And you know, look at the prison system in the U.S. and the cartels that are, you know, controlling major parts of major countries in the world, all because of this, you know, this big problem with drug use. So these three perspectives: the first person, I am an addict. Hello, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Two. Hi, Bob, you're an alcoholic and I'm talking to you. And three is kind of looking at from the third person perspective, like, oh, let's look at addiction. In other words, when we talk about the four quadrants, you know, we'll talk about the upper right quadrant being the body and the brain. And we look at addiction as a brain disease and blah, blah. Now that's taking the third person perspective. Okay. We're looking at it as something, me and you conversing, looking at something objectively outside of ourselves. It's also very valuable. Now, in internal work, you know, in the 3-2-1 of God, and we just say that because, you know, God is the word for that, you know, that presence, that mystery that that we seem to encounter, you know, higher power, they say in AA parlance, you know, essential self, the big I, every, you know, Allah, every spiritual tradition has a different name for it. And of course, also you need to realize that every level of development has a different understanding of what that means. So as my friend Rolly Stanich says, we look at God through colored glasses. In other words, so if you're If you're looking at God from a red perspective, you're seeing, you're understanding that mystery through the interpretive tools that are available for red. Same thing with blue, same thing with orange, same thing with green, same thing with integral. So it's not just this one thing, but we actually, you know, perceive different parts of it and see it from different perspectives as we, you know, move up to whatever levels of development we're at. And hopefully at the integral levels, we begin to include, you know, all the prior perspectives, you know, plus this new perspective that begins to emerge. Would we understand the universe and things in an integral way? So to boil down to it, so say you're, and you can, you know, all of the, and the reason this is important, because it actually gives us permission to explore and to let these different perspectives be part of our inner work. And if we only relegate it to one or two of these perspectives, it impoverishes our inner work. And if we have, you know, certain, you know, teachings or things that said, well, you know, it's not cool to look at it that way or something like that, that'll hinder what actually comes up. So, you know, you're starting to meditate and you say you're having a bad day and you start thinking about God, like, you know, am I going to pray God, you know, God, I don't even like God. I don't even believe in God. You know, if I've God, I'd have a much better universe than this one. There's so much suffering and stupidity running around. That, and I'm just projecting some of my early battles with the divine, by the way. Somebody said that Jews don't pray, they argue, you know. I was very much like that in my prayer at a certain stage of my development. So anyway, so just talking about God or thinking about God as a concept, as an idea, as a mystery, as a subject of theological inquiry, that's God in third person, and that's completely useful, and you will find your mind doing it, okay? Now, the second person perspective on that is when you actually talk to God as other, someone that you're in relationship with, some presence, some being, some mystery. If you want good, the poetry of Rumi, one of my favorites, is really good on that. He's also good on the first person perspective, but we'll get to that in a moment. So, and why this is important. Now you find that, I mean, the second person perspective is probably the perspective that is most popular in AA, for example, you know, step 11 and asking God to remove our faults and through prayer and meditation, et cetera. So God is talking about as higher power other than ourselves. Here we are, the poor, you know, defeated addicts, and we need help from higher power. Good enough. However, that's that perspective is hard for a lot of people because, you know, when you move beyond kind of a blue fundamentalist mythic level version of story of God, often the whole idea of saying, you know, dear daddy in the sky, you know, please help me, sounds very childish and really stupid. You know, which, you know, probably is on some level. So we let go of that second person perspective, and we get into, you know, Eastern mysticism and Buddhism or something where you get into the first person perspective, which is basically in the Hindu tradition, they say Brahman is Atman. And Atman is Brahman. So Brahman is the word for the all, the one, the universe, everything is God, okay? And Atman is the deepest part of the individual human, the human soul, if you will. Those deep, deep, deep parts of us that we, you know, that I talk about a lot in terms of inner work, contemplative work, and really joining or getting taste and kind of stabilizing a connection to that through our practices. So that it illuminates the rest of our lives and makes recovery and the journey beyond recovery possible. And Atman, so when it says Atman is Brahman, is Brahman, Brahman is Atman, in other words, the divinity that you define, that you find in yourselves, that we find in ourselves through our yoga, through our prayer, through our meditation, through our work, is none other than the divinity that is the all. Okay, and that's a pretty startling, you know, realization. And we come to those unit of experiences at times, and in meditation, or sometimes, you know, sitting on a park bench like Eckhart Tolle, and or, you know, praying on a mountain, or however it comes to us, and boom, all of a sudden the ego boundaries go away. You know, our little individual self, ego encapsulated, skin encapsulated self, and that just dissolves, and there is nothing but this oneness. And it is all one. It is all very beautiful, and it's very mysterious, and it is, you know, it's samadhi. It's very powerful, great, okay? And so we can kind of deal with that, because that kind of bypasses the, you know, the whole fundamentalist thing of, you know, God is the guy, you know, the white guy with the gray beard, and, you know, on the throne with Jesus at his right hand, and, you know, angels and all the stuff that are just, you know, they're like the big NSA in the sky, you know, and knows all your thoughts and reads your emails and is preparing a file so you get whacked in accordance with justice or whatever that is. So that we needed, you know, anyway, mercy and all the stuff to, you know. So that's kind of hard to swallow when you get to an orange or rational level of development or beyond. So many of us have bypass that second person connection, where you just pour your heart out to this presence, this mystery. And, you know, you ask and pray for guidance, and you converse with it as the divine other. And in Kin's teaching, which really helped me, because I'm always geared that way anyway, but I felt stupid for doing it, or do it as much as I could have, because I felt it was childish. But we really do need that loving relationship with the divine presence, with the other. So all this to say,
these are all... This is Heidi breaking in, John.
Yeah.
We're getting a lot of funny noise while you talk.
I sound okay now?
Yeah, you do.
Hello.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, send me the number in case it breaks down, but I'll continue.
Okay.
As it were. So, okay. Getting back to that often as we move from blue into orange, or from the mythic kind of fundamentalist type religious perspective into the modernistic and more science and rationality, that the whole second person perspective seems to be kind of silly and childish. Well, yeah, and I mean, that's developmental and that's okay. But after a while, I think we find in the deepest places that we impoverish our practice if we don't have that capacity to speak with the divine as a second person, as in, you know, hello, great mystery, or hello, Lord, or however you want, or hello, goddess, or ma'am, or however you want to say that, and just pour your heart out in a loving relationship with it. So that seems to really kind of be built in to the, you know, our spiritual DNA, the necessity of that relationship. So if that sounds kind of weird to you, or something that you're already doing and you're comfortable with, well, that's good. Know that if you're doing it, yeah, you don't have to feel bad about it. You know, you don't have to feel like you're being childish in taking that perspective. Now, you may be very childish in what you're asking for or what you're doing, but, you know, hey, I think the present meets us wherever we're at. So we don't have to learn, you know, have to speak maturely or hear something. And if you kind of rejected that part and kind of gone the way of a lot of us into, yeah, I'm okay with the first person. In other words, I am the all, and that experience that happens, probably a lot of us got that first experience or taste of that doing mushrooms or LSD or some kind of psychedelic back in the day. And we're okay with that. So I'm just saying that all three of these perspectives are absolutely legitimate, and they're absolutely necessary. And you can actually, you know, in one meditation, you can, you know, switch all three perspective lenses, you know, in a short period of time. You know, you can go from, okay, thinking about God, thinking about the mystery, thinking about that presence, to okay, Lord John here, and you know me better than I know myself, so I need some help here, because it's getting pretty dark, or whatever your prayer might be. and into those moments when finally, you know, the mind calms down, or those moments we have the spaciousness arises and we have those unitive experiences that are so necessary for our health. And, you know, Maslow talked about that. Abraham Maslow, one of my, you know, heroes in the field of psychology, and he was one of the real movers and shakers in the humanistic psychology movement back in the 60s. And then when transpersonal psychology started coming up in the 70s and 80s, and I think he's the one that actually coined the term transpersonal psychology, which meant a psychology, an ego psychology that includes both the, you know, the ego self, which is what Western psychology deals with most of the time, is individual psychology, and the transcendent self, the big self, the big I, the spiritual dimension of human experience. So hence a transpersonal. So you're including the personal, but you're also transcending it. So, yeah, so both of those experiences, all of those experiences are really necessary. And one of Maslow's beautiful insights, he said that, you know, most of Western psychology has been developed by studying sick people, right? Freud with neurotics and, you know, abused kids and, you know, Jung. We study pathology to find the path. And that's, yeah, we've learned a lot from that. But he said, well, why don't we turn this thing on its head and study really, really healthy people, you know, really exemplars of what it means to be human, and see if we can find any universals, anything that connects the dots and say, oh, these are the things that that all of these people that were studying these exemplars share in common. And one of the things he came up with was that they had these moments of transcendent experience. And he said, you know, that, and so apparently that kind of unitive peak experience, as he called them, to kind of try to, you know, take the religiosity out of it. But he said it seems that in all these cases that he studied, that they all had these peak experiences, either, you know, more than once, or, you know, often or at least once. And those experiences, when the ego boundaries go away and you have this kind of numinous clarity, where you the understanding is you're seeing deeply into the essential nature of reality, and behold, it is beautiful beyond description, and it fills you with ecstasy and peace and connectedness. So, so all of these perspectives are necessary and a healthy part of it. And if you are you know, weak in any one of those three, or maybe all three, you can just know because of this lecture that these things are very useful, and that you can experience them consciously in your inner work. And of course that will begin to overflow into your outer work, into the rest of the time, you know, in your dreams and in your walk a day world conscious reality. So any questions on the 3-2-1 of God? Was that somewhat clear?
Yeah, this is Lisa. Yeah. I really appreciate it because I really struggled with, through a lot of self-inquiry, having that non-dualistic experience, and yet there's still the ego, and giving myself permission to also interact with the divine as something in the second person again.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, okay, everything is one except for duality.
Yeah, exactly.
And I rejected that, and I felt horribly lonely.
Yeah.
Sort of in that, you know, it was sort of like, oh yeah, God is everything, so I'm all alone. There's only one. And so, you know, I really appreciate it, and you've reinforced myself. Just giving myself permission to have that dialogue, it's like it made me think about if God is everything and I'm a finger on the body of God, I'm not separate. I'm not made of separate stuff, but I can still touch myself. I can still have a conversation with the second person, divine, And for me, it's, you know what, it's comforting. It's comforting, and I'm still an ego, and I just appreciate what you said, because I indoctrinated myself on the other pole, that there's only one, so there's no one to talk to. There's nothing separate. You know, that can become another ego thing,
right,
too.
Another a dogmatic trap in itself, yeah.
Yeah, it's dualism at its highest form, this non-duality thing.
Right.
It's all one except for separation. But here I am in a world where things appear separate. So I just, it was a really difficult time, and it was a time during which I relapsed. So what you're saying to me is really important.
Yeah, and then you beautifully expressed it, and that you just encapsulated it, a lot of our experiences. And to come back to
that, like you, other people have experienced that too?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's helpful.
And it's interesting too how you said that kind of spiritual wounding was you know, it was very painful, and it was occurring at a time that when you relapse. So, you know, to reestablish that connection and realize it's absolutely legitimate and it's real and it's been reported by all the great mystics forever and ever and ever. And yeah, we live in this non-dual thing that goes on, and we're one informs the other, or at least the non-dual informs the dualistic side of the street, and really helps us to see into it essentially, and illuminates it so that we can live our, you know, existence as a separate ego in a way that has very porous boundaries, that's open to everything and open to that inspiration and strength that comes from the recognition of who and what we really are ultimately on the non-dual side of the street. So
that's it.
Very cool.
Thank you. It's really
helpful. Yeah, you're welcome. So that's not what I wanted to talk about. I mean, I kind of did, but the main thing was going to be the 3-2-1 of shadow. And as I said, this thing this developed really independently, just out of my own practice and my own my persistent, you know, shadow things and all my wounding and all my hurt and all the stuff that was keeping me ill. And so this is it in a nutshell. And so you're in meditation. Okay, so you have your headphones on, you're sitting on your cushion, and something starts to come up, and you start to get into this kind of, you know, dark, scary place. And I'll just tell you about, you know, one of the ones that I dealt with, and you can do any version of that you will. So a lot of times in my depression and my pain, there would be this part of me that I would just loathe myself. I'm just, you know, God, I'm just, you know, the worst, you know, person ever. I'm just so bad. I'm so unworthy of anything. And in a conversation earlier today, I think, what did I call it? I called it, it's a type of narcissism. But it's like not like, oh, it's all about me. It's the other side of the coin is like, oh, I'm worse than everything else. You know, I'm you know, I am the ultimate bad guy on the planet in creation, which is like kind of inflated. So anyway, so I would get to that place, and what I would do is the first thing I as this thing kind of emerged is I would look at this part of myself in the third person. And I would give it a name, for example, self-loathing John. And I would see in my mind's eye, as I was meditating, I'd see an image of myself, loathing myself. So, you know, I'd probably kind of be scrunched over and, you know, my arm across my heart and another hand covering my eyes and just this really just withdrawn blast of self-loathing, okay? And so I would just look at that image of self-loathing John, and I would start to feel, really pay attention to the sensations in my body, that while I was experiencing self-loathing, what I was feeling in my body, and of course, you know, the mental messages, you know, it's just like, oh my God, you know, you're just so hopelessly pathetic, you know, whatever that was. And so I would sit with that and just look at the vision of myself loathing myself, image of this part of me that loathed myself, and then I just feeling the sensations in my body. And then when the time came, I would make the shift to the second part. And I would start talking to that that part of myself as an other. So I would say, "Hey, self-loathing John, how are you?" Or something like that, you know. And it, you know, it's like I can just see this version of myself that kind of looking between its fingers, an eyeball poking out, going, "What? How do you think I'm feeling? I hate myself. You know, I loathe myself." I said, "Okay." And, you know, and I would just start a conversation with it, a dialogue. And I found that most of the time that these parts really, really want to talk, unless it's some like pre-verbal, you know, part of myself. But usually they really appreciated the contact. And so I said, "Okay, well, how are you feeling? I feel terrible, blah, blah." And I said, "Well, why do you, you know, why do you loathe yourself so much?" And self-loathing John would say something like, "Well, I mean, you know, I mean, my God, there's so much. It's like, I've never done anything right, you know. It's just like I've never reached any of my goals. I've disappointed everyone, you know. And I just, and this time I did that and I failed and again I failed and I, you know, blah, blah, blah," you know, just lay it all out. You're going, uh-huh, you're listening to this. At the same time, you're in, you know, conversation with this part of yourself. You always have it anchored in your body, in the soma. So you're always feeling sensations that are arising in your body as you're doing this work. That's very, very key, because if it's not anchored in the gross body and the subtle body, it'll just be another, you know, intellectual, you know, exercise, and it won't get the work done. So it has to be anchored to the body. So then, you know, and I said, "Okay, well, great, thank you. Anything else?" "Well, yeah." And blah, 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 you know, and then get poured out. And so then if you're, you know, if you have any, like, wise therapeutic question that comes up, you can ask it. But eventually I get to the point, I'm feeling all this in my body, and it's pretty heavy, and it's just dark, and it's, you know, it's usually my heart and my gut, you know, it's just this feeling of thickness and this kind of real thick, you know, swirly, not very fast swirling, but just churning, if you will, darkness. I said, "Okay, well, self-loathing John, what would it take for you not to loathe yourself?" And self-loathing John would go, "Well, oh, God, it'd take a lot. There's so much." Yeah, I know. "But what would it take? What would it really take for you not to loathe yourself?" And self-loathing John will sit with that. "Oh." Says, I don't know. Maybe I just have to be just totally infused with the light of God and just have all that, all my just yuckiness and awfulness just washed away, and real sense that I've been cleansed and forgiven, and, you know, just it's gone, you know. I guess that's what it would take." Wow. "Yeah, that's a great answer. So, okay, self-loving, why don't you come home, little brother?" And at that point, I will shift into the first-person perspective and bring it all home, no longer talking to something outside of myself. And I just bring it home and just hold all the feelings that arise with that self-loathing in my own heart, my own body, and just stay with it as those feelings do whatever they need to do. And they percolate, they churn, and they intensify, or they do whatever. And eventually, just keep breathing and staying present with that. And, you know, the centering meditation, the mind wanders, just, you know, have your word, thank you, whatever brings that, being totally conscious of what's in your, of what's going on somatically in your body, and it eventually that will begin to lift and shift, and you'll have actually integrated and gotten a big, maybe all of it. Sometimes we can work with issues and we really, you know, work through it and transmute it in some mysterious form through our body and our awareness, And we work through it. Sometimes we work through a big chunk of it, you know, and maybe we have to come back later and do work as it arises in our practice. So that's basically the practice, doing the third person perspective of this part. And you see, it helps to re-own shadow elements, because in the beginning it's outside of yourself. Okay, you're seeing it as other, and then you work towards more and more of owning it and acceptance. In the second part, you're actually conversing with it, so it's no longer you completely, but it's kind of still outside of you. You're talking with it, kind of being a therapist to your own you know, wounded part, your own rejected part, your own kind of repressed or personality. And then finally, after you've become comfortable with it in the second and the third person, you just bring it home and you completely own it, and you allow that part of yourself just to express itself and feel whatever it needs to feel on the path to healing. And that is, you know, it's a really nice tool to use when you're starting to become aware of parts of you that are really hurt and really wounded, and that you've really kind of been scared to look at or not wanted to look at because of the fear of, you know, what do we fear? We fear we'll get stuck in that, you know, wounded part, and we'll just be, you know, hate ourselves rather, and you know, all this stuff. And often the strategy is, of course, to avoid that confrontation, avoid that reunification, avoid that integration, and use drugs and alcohol to try to numb it, forget about it, or project it, or just seal it off down wherever we seal these things off, and they don't stay buried. They come out in pathological symptoms. You know, somebody said what we bury in the basement of our unconscious grows up in the front yard as a big, you know, whatever, and in a healthy form. So it's a way of identifying it, being with it, completely anchoring it in the body. Because remember, all trauma work has to be focused in the body, or it's not going to work. Whether you're dealing, you know, with individual trauma or collective trauma or whatever it is, and then by just owning it, and bringing it home, saying thank you and being present with it. Mm. And that's how you do it. Any comments or questions at this point?
This is Victoria. I had read about this, and I've actually practiced it myself, but your description really did bring it home, and just give a sense of that whole progression from shadow to completely owning and integrating. Mm-hmm. What a beautiful practice.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, like anything else that we do, the more you work with it, the better you'll get. You know,
John. Yeah, I thank you for that description. I understand it well. Like Victoria, I've read on it before. I've never done it. I never really thought about it, so it was good to hear an explanation of it. I still don't see how that can make me feel better about parts of myself that I really reject, that I just do not like. And I don't see how I can see how talking to it and acknowledging it would be there, but then to really bring it in and let it percolate and sit with it. My concern is that I'll sit in that for so long,
yeah,
that I'll end up just really, it'll just fester, and I'll just end up getting worse and like hating that part of myself even more. I don't see how that can release it.
Yeah.
If you're calling it.
Yeah, and that's how we release it. And that's a really you know, that's a really logical fear. And that's why we don't want to open those dark cans of worms, you know, because just as you're saying, man, if I look at this, it'll crush me, it'll overwhelm me, it'll control me, it'll kill me, you know, and all my life I've been running and trying to not to not to do that. And but the lesson is, the teaching is that that's how we actually finally heal those things, by completely bringing them in and just letting them do their thing in somatically. And the 3-2-1 is a way of kind of inviting that in gradually into the body. And that's where the work needs to be done. And yeah, all of this stuff, I mean, it just takes a lot of our psychic energy, if you will, to keep these things in their closets, you know, in the basement, chained up so they don't come and overwhelm us. And when we actually finally allow them to come out and express themselves, it's really a corrective experience, they say in therapy talk, when these things are actually allowed to do whatever they have to do. And then that's how they release. And it's really, it seems to be a very interesting transmutation of energy. And what really helps is to have the observer self also present, so you just don't get overwhelmed, you know, that you're completely identified with, you know, with the pain, with the darkness that you're actually embracing. You're the witness self is completely free and of it and observing it and going, oh, well, isn't that interesting, and blessing it. So at one time you're completely in it, and the other part you're completely free. It's kind of this larger context of the being open spaciousness and awareness that all this stuff arises in. So that's when, you know, we talk in integral speak, you know, you have your physical body or your gross body and your subtle body engaged, which where all this stuff is actually churning out, you know, percolating out, if you will. And then the third body, the third sheath they talk about is the causal body, which is the pure awareness that it all arises in. And when you really have those things going full blast at the same time, man, you can really get through this stuff quite quickly. And yeah, so you kind of have to, you know, take my word on it, on faith maybe in the beginning, but as you begin to work with it, it will begin to shift. And even if you, you know, just touch into it, you know, and it just, and then you freak out and you're not ready to do the whole thing. Even that, I think, just touching into it can, like, it's like releasing some of the steam, some of the power it has. So you can go back and just keep working on whatever particular issues have kept you kept you down and kept you, suffering. So, Hamlet, does that answer at all?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Anything else or anyone else?
Yeah, it's Lisa again. I heard you months ago before we met. I was listening to something I downloaded. I think it was you and, oh, I don't remember, somebody interviewing you. And you talked about this, and you said something that you said, and I'll even spend the day with the part of me that is self-hatred. And it was like a revelation, because I did that day. And it was like, oh, I don't have to pretend there isn't a part that hates me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like bringing it to light. I couldn't stop giggling. I mean, it was like hilarity that I felt such shame, you know, in a world of you should love yourself bullshit. And it was just like I felt so much more whole. And I wanted to thank you for that, because it was just maybe a small thing you said, but a big thing that I experienced when I dialogued with it. And then that night I used the recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I had kind of a, and it kind of goes to what Hamlet was saying, I had kind of a spontaneous visualization of an aspect of me that had been split off, and it felt like it came when I was ready for it. Like there's a natural built-in mechanism that wasn't going to bring me something that was going to be too painful for me to handle.
Right.
And it was a part of me that I really hated that is just filled with self-pity.
Yeah.
And I wrote down what happened. It's not very long. Do you mind if I read it?
No, that'd be great. Thank you.
I think I posted it on your website, but we didn't really know each other then, so you might not have even seen it. But this is a visualization, and I wrote it down this way. A knock came at my door. There in the rain I stood, small and young and bedraggled, "Why are you out in the rain?" I asked this little me. "I feel sorry for myself," she answered. "And they told you that was not allowed, so you threw me out into the cold." She cried, scowling. Come in," I implored. "Tell me, when did I do this to you?" She stared at the floors, tears dripping from her eyes, and whispered, "Long, long ago." As she took a seat, I handed her a towel, and I asked her, "Why did you come to me?" "I have tried forever to get comfort from you," she replied, "but you don't listen. They told you I shouldn't exist, so you ignored me. I threw rocks through your windows, and still you pretended I was not there. Self-pity was not allowed in your home. So I became depressed, and I ate pie filling and biscuits and threw tantrums and took drugs, hoping you would pay me some attention. I tried to kill me. I felt so unwanted, and still you never came. What was it you needed from me? What is it you need from me now?" I softly asked, taking her into my lap. "Just some comfort, just to know it's okay that I exist, because I do. I feel sorry for myself." Then her eyes well up with tears, and she says softly, "I was only trying to protect you from being ignored, so they would see you were hurt. So they would ask you what you needed. So someone would take care of you, and you threw me away," she sobs quietly. Crying, I told her, I hold her and take her into my heart, feeling all she is feeling, knowing her pain and welcoming her home. When she's all cried out, I rub her hair dry with the towel. "Do you need me to ask for what I need so you don't have to do it from now on?" I ask. Her head flies up and she gasps, "Oh, that would be wonderful," and jumps off my lap and onto the floor. "Could you do that? Would you do that?" "I will try my best," I assure her. You're welcome to remind me if I fail to notice, and you know I might not get what I ask for, right?" "Oh, that's okay," she says. "You can give me what I need all by yourself." Startled and delighted at her response, I watch as she scampers out the door and into the meadow, her hair flying behind her. She stops, turns, and waves at me, this long-lost piece of myself. Together, we have welcomed ourselves home. And now, when I feel her feeling sorry for herself, I know to welcome her in, ask her what she needs, and how she's trying to serve me. And I take her into my arms and heart until she's ready to run free again. Until we're ready to run free again. That's it. And that was like just from that little thing you said. And it was so meaningful because that whole thing right there is the 3-2-1 process.
Yeah, beautifully, beautifully expressed. And also to realize that, you know, when that part of yourself, you know, got that message that, you know, feeling sorry for yourself or self-pity was not permitted, it was probably, you know, that was probably could have been an accurate assessment of the adult world around you. Where
truth. And then in recovery, in traditional recovery, it just reinforced it. I reinforced it in myself.
Yeah. So you know, honor that part of yourself and that decision you made at that point. But it's no longer, you know, that war is over. You know?
Yeah, like she doesn't need to run the show anymore because I see her, you know, she doesn't need to run the show anymore. It's like what Hamlet said, just being aware that there's that part is the waking up from the trance of it in a way.
Yeah, but now your adult self can actually nurture and accept and heal that part of yourself, and there is a loving adult now, you know, and it's you, you know.
Yeah, I felt like I could take care of those parts without letting them unconsciously run the show, but yeah. I could take care of them, and when I, you know, just telling her, I'll ask for what I want, I may not get it, but I won't leave you in the cold, you know, it's just such a experience internally.
Yeah, you know, and on some level we are really pitiful, you know. And we need to be held, and we need to, you know, to have that adult maternal or paternal presence that can tell us that, you know, that it's okay. It's okay to feel those feelings. And like you said, that if you don't, you know, if that's not given permission to express itself and be held in awareness and in acceptance, then it comes out in it gets, you know, it'll get its needs met in other ways.
It gets mad.
Yeah, it gets mad and, you know, all kinds of things, you know, the pie fillings and the drugs and whatever, you know, whatever it is. So, wow.
Yeah.
Lisa, that was a really good narrative book. Did you do that before, did you write that before you ever came across the three to one process?
I had just heard John, well, I'd done a lot of voice dialogue, but I had just heard John on a recording of in an interview talk about basically the 3-2-1 thing on his self-hatred, and similar to what you shared today, John. And I'd heard it on the radio, and then I did the recordings that night, and then the next day that sort of just like was a visualization that came to me, and I let it come, and that's how I experienced it and wrote it down.
I feel like there's so much repression for me going on that I'm just like starting to be very faintly aware of it now, and I'm afraid of what could possibly come up. You know, it reminds me, I would go to my parents' house, there's these pictures that my mom has when I was about 8 or 9. And sometimes I've looked at those pictures and my eyes have just filled up with tears because I forgot that little boy, right? Like I forgot, and there were so many dreams and so many goals and so much life that I took off. I'm not even going to say was taken out. I just decided to do what I did. And a lot of that I've forgotten about, you know, and it's when I stare at those pictures, and I was 8 years old and I said, man, what the fuck happened? Happened, you know? And yeah, I mean, I can say, you know, my life is good today. Yeah. But there's still all that shit that hasn't been healed, you know, and that hasn't come up. And I don't know, you know, and I'm afraid of when it does. And hearing you talk and this talk on forgiveness and the 3-2-1 is just starting to faintly make me become aware of those parts of myself that I've ignored, that I've rejected, that I don't like others to see, that I don't show to the world, you know. It's scary.
Yeah, it is scary. It is scary. And of course, one of my favorite sayings, that fear is the existential validation that something is worth doing, you know, often. So that fear is a good thing. And what you can do just in your meditation is like when something starts to come up and you start getting scared, it just bring awareness and mindfulness to the fear. And let that be your meditation. And that just will, you know, that will just, that consciousness you bring to the resistance, often just the resistance will resolve itself, you know, will let go. And sometimes when I don't want to meditate, I'll just sit there and I can't get still. And I'll just, so my meditation, the first door of my meditation will be to focus on my resistance. What's trying to keep me from not meditating today? And it's usually just my ego scared to look at something, you know, doesn't want to get into something that's ready to surface. And Hamlin, another possible good practice that I've done in the past with some pretty good results and recommended to others is, you know, you can get a picture of yourself as a child and, you know, get on your cushion and put that picture in front of you with maybe a couple of candles around it and just, you know, get down in meditative space and keep your eyes, you know, relaxed, but on the picture, and see if that image of your young self has anything to teach you. You know, and you can also do that work with a parent, you know, or your parents or people that you've had, you know, kind of really important relationships with in the past that you haven't been able to work through. They may be, you know, may have been passed on. They're not even alive. You can do this kind of work.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's all, you know, the very foundations and beginnings of modern Western therapy with Freud. What, you know, Freud said that the purpose of the unconscious or of therapy was to make the unconscious conscious. And that's very true. And we know a little more about how to do that, you know. And so we have, you know, we have the shadow rejected parts of ourselves that you both described very, very well, things that we're just scared to look at. You know, because of our judgments, because we were told that it was not okay, or because you're afraid that it'll just overpower you, you know, and your whole kind of, you know, ego strategy, consciously or unconsciously, will be to avoid that stuff and try to appear and try to function at a high level, which is completely understandable. But when you realize that eventually all that stuff is going to keep you down and you need to bring it back into awareness. And on the other hand, the other side of the street, you know, we have our dark shadows, we have our light shadows too. You know, we have the brilliant parts of ourselves, that one expression that we won't express for whatever reasons, because we're not worthy, because we were told we couldn't do that, or because, oh, I don't believe in God, or, you know, so we close ourselves down to spiritual experiences because of our, you know, kind of rigid mental conditionings. So we know that you have that part of you too, and you can use the same 3-2-1 process on stuff, you know, it's your genius author, you know, writer part that you've always suppressed because, you know, I can't write, I'm not smart enough, I don't deserve success, or whatever your stories are, and work with it and bring that in. And just as the dark and wounded parts of ourselves that are forced into some kind of unhealthy repression still have energy and still come out through the pores in other ways that are unhealthy, so our gifts also, if we don't cultivate them, we don't allow them to flourish and flower into the world, will cause us spiritual, emotional, and even physical illness. And, you know, there's that great verse from the Gospel of Thomas, the one that was uncovered in the Egyptian deserts in 1945, where Jesus says, if you keep that within you, it will kill you, but if you bring it forth, it will bring you life. So that's a very wise, deeply spiritual saying of Jesus that was recorded and lost and refound, that was never in any of the Gospels that we were given permission to read, you know, back in the day. So, yeah, that's a great thing to include here. It's the light shadow.
And it seems to that just I was afraid to face, because I thought, quote unquote, I believed I wouldn't be able to handle them. Ironically, that wasn't true, and it was like in turning towards those split off parts that I started to find my heart's desire, you know, that sense of connectedness and love and compassion. And it was the opposite of what I thought. Like, I totally get what Hamlet's saying, like, I won't be able to handle it. Is that true? And yeah, I was not only able to handle it, but it started to open up my heart in the deepest sense to myself and others, you know, and the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's another great point, and a really important point is that when we actually hang out with these things, when they do, we do go through that integration and acceptance and transmutation. And I struggle with the words to explain, but that's what the felt sense, it feels like, it's all of that. Then something emerges from that, new energy, a new gift, a new connection. And we don't know what that's going to be, you know. And it's like you can't, you know, Hamlet, you know, you're talking about being scared of looking at all this stuff, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen. Know that you, if you do the work, that it will heal and it will not kill you, and it will come out, there'll be something else there when the work is done. And there's the three quartets, T.S. Eliot, there's that verse where he talks about, you know, when you're sitting in the darkness, you know, you sit there with no hope because you would only hope for the wrong thing, because you don't know exactly what the new thing is going to be. There's no way to know, so you can't be attached to what you think the outcomes ought to be, because the outcomes will be what they are and what they need to be. So we just hang out in that emptiness and not knowing. And that takes, on some level, some deep faith in the process. And that faith already exists in us. You don't have to find that from the outside. It's already there, to get you through it. And, of course, you know, we can, you know, if you need support from your community and from people that, you know, have done the work too, that's fine.
And I should know that looking at these things, I mean, very recently, I was able to go back and actually make amends to, you know, I lived with, back in 2000, I found my girlfriend at the time dead in our bedroom. She died from meningitis. She went in 24 hours. She got sick with what I thought was a cold, and I left for work. And when I came back that day, she was gone. She just, there was just a freak accident, and she left behind these two small children. And I swore up and down. I mean, this is a devastating event in my life, and I swore that I would, you know, that I would get my act together. I was going to make it, you know, make it so these kids can go to college, and I was going to, you know, I had big, big plans. And of course, like every good addict, that didn't pan out too well. And after she passed away, I saw them maybe two or three times, and 14 years went by. 14 years, man, that I carried this like horrendous weight on my shoulders, this shame and this guilt, this like this dark skeletons in my closet that I just completely ran from that responsibility because I kept using. And man, it just like, I came to a point where I said, I have to write a letter. And the kids have grown up, you know, they're 18 and 20 years old. And I found out where they were at, and I reached out just to make amends and said, you know, this is what happened. And when your mother passed away, I swore that, you know, I would be there. And I failed miserably in that capacity. I did not live up to my promise. I'm sorry. I would like to see you guys. You guys meant the world to me. If you have it in your heart, whatever, I wrote this letter. They responded, and I got a chance to meet them again. And it was the easiest, most just, it wasn't awkward. It was actually like, just my heart lit up. Like that day I was walking around with a grin from ear to ear, and I felt like this mountain had been lifted off my shoulders, this thing that I had avoided for 14 years, that wow. Ate me up for 14 years, was so easy to do once I took that step, and so easy to confront, you know? So I should learn from that experience that these other areas that I'm have been hesitant to look at are probably not as ugly as I think they are.
Wow, you know? Well said.
Yeah, you know, and I think we all, I mean, all of us who are, you know, at this stage of the journey have had those experiences of betrayal of others, betrayals of ourselves that just, you know, that are so painful and that could actually kill us, you know, because of the shame and, you know, doing the drugs and trying to avoid it and blah, blah, blah. But once we own that and we get it, well, the fruits of that deep work and that reconciliation and the making amends, both outer and inner amends and reconciliation, is wisdom. And innocence comes from the Latin, it means before the wound, okay? And we lose our wound when we fall into the pain of our fall, of our betrayal, or these things that we've done, or the things that were done to us, that's no longer there. And so when we lose our innocence, you know, that's an essential, almost a something holy, if you will, because it's what leads us finally to healing and to wisdom and to being initiated into who and what we really are, with the acceptance of all of it, the good, the bad, you know, the indifferent, the ugly, the beautiful. And then we come through that in a way that is integrated and truly integral and transformed, and we can move from a place of deep wisdom and compassion and understanding that, yeah, you know, that we're all in the same boat together, you know, on the dual side of the street, as you were saying earlier. And but the separation begins to become less rigid, if you will. So yeah, very beautiful. Thank you, Hamlet. That was
yeah. Thanks.
Oh well. I think that's about time to wrap it. Well, this was certainly something extraordinary, at least on my end of the connection here. So thank you, guys. And you keep me coming back. So any closing thoughts or anything before we sign off here?
This is just Heidi saying, I would love to say on Friday we could talk more about this because it's so interesting, but John's going to be doing a dialogue with Bob in California in the Master Lecture Series on Friday during this time. So hopefully you guys can all tune into that, and then we can pick this back up the following week.
Yeah. Heidi, is it during this time?
It is. So we're just not going to have the group discussion forum. I thought just so everybody could hopefully tune into that lecture. It starts at 11 Mountain Time, like this class does, and goes for 2 hours.
Perfect.
And people can, there's a moderator to accept questions, so you can just write in questions if you're watching online.
Yeah, so you can actually participate with questions and comments online, and that will qualify as the forum. And yeah, it'll be two people, you know, me and Bob, in dialogue about integral recovery. And hopefully, you know, every time that we engage with this stuff, it's like we got into areas that I had no idea we're going to get into today. That's just what happens when you work with it. It begins to reveal itself. And especially the way you guys show up and share from your experience and all that. Anyway, so try to be there next week or this week, right? That's on Friday. I'll feel you guys' presence there anyway. So thank you, everybody.
Will do. Thank you, John.
God bless.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.